I'm looking forward to hearing his wisdom and his insight into the AA program. And with that, I will give you from the Lest We Forgive group on Sunday night right here at Napa, Spencer.
Thanks, Mike. My name is Spencer. I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Lest We Forget group. I also have another home group, the Wednesday Nighters. My sobriety date is January 19th, 1985. Anybody got a Valium? The good news is that I've been really busy at work for the past few weeks. Tim asked me to do this last month after I celebrated my 27th year, and we got really busy at work, so I haven't had a whole lot of time to think about this and get up in my head about it. So that's the good news. The bad news is that I've had a lot of work to do, so you know, telling what you're going to get tonight. I haven't really thought about this. I mean, I've kind of thought about it today more than any other day, but I just want to try and speak from my heart most of all. And I love that part that Mike read in the big book where it says, you know, the each member tells his story about how he found God. You know, it's not about how I stopped drinking. I mean, that's a direct result of finding God. But and for a lot of years, I didn't know that is really the purpose of AA, is how I established a relationship with my God. So I'd like to tell what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I've told my story. It's been a while since I've told my story here at NABA. And it seems like every time I tell my story, I always get caught up in the, you know, what I used to be like. And I look up at the clock, and it's 10 till, you know, and I haven't even gotten to what it's like today. Because really the best part for me is what is like today, you know, what my life is like today. I did ask Tim last night. I thought maybe the next purchase he could get would be a couple of teleprompters, you know, and that way it wouldn't have to take the pressure off me, and I could just kind of swivel my head from side to side and, you know, look real good doing it. But anyway, I was born in Tampa, Florida, 1956. Youngest of four kids. My father was a colonel in the Air Force, and my mother a housewife, and they couldn't have been more opposites. He obviously was a military man, very conservative. She was, you know, early 60s liberal, hippie type, and I honestly, to this day, do not know what they had in common. You know, they other than he was her ticket, you know, out of Buffalo Center or Iowa. And, you know, they had four kids, but they were always at odds. And growing up as a kid, there were a lot of fights, a lot of screaming, a lot of yelling, a lot of arguing, throwing things, dishes, whatnot. We traveled around a lot. My being a military brat, you know, we weren't in any one place more than a couple of years. And I think some of the earliest and best memories I have is we were, my dad got transferred to Hawaii, Oahu, Hawaii in 1963. And we spent 3 years over there. And those for us kids were really the best, you know, most vivid, fun memories. A beautiful place to live, you know, back then. But they would have a lot of parties, and I always, to this day, remember watching them get drunk. And as a kid, seeing your parents get out of control and sloppy, and it was just very, very dark. And you know, again, they threw a lot of things around and yelling and screaming. And they That's also where in Hawaii there, where I got first sip of beer. My mother gave me a sip of her Primo beer. That was the big beer in Hawaii, and I was probably 7 years old. And I remember thinking, boy, this is awful stuff. You know, what is this? How can people drink this rot gut stuff? And, you know, little did I know what was going to happen to me. But they fought a lot, like I said, And I think all of us kids, four of us, we learned to, you know, stuff that stuff inside, seeing all the chaos going around us. My parents were married and divorced three times to each other, and I won't say that that's the cause of my alcoholism, but it certainly contributed to it. So you can imagine growing up in a house like that, there was a lot of chaos. But after Hawaii, we moved back to the States around Washington, D.C. and Virginia area for a few years, and my mom was a restless spirit. We moved, you know, within the same city. He was stationed in the same place, but my mom was always moving. You know, she was, every couple of years she wanted to move somewhere. And you know, as it turns out, no big surprise, she was also an alcoholic, and she became one of us, and she died sober, 2006 rather. So we moved back there, and, you know, growing up as a kid in that kind of environment was pretty chaotic, and I had a lot of bad influence friends and, you know, hanging out with the wrong kind of crowd, but didn't really, there was no, you know, drug use or alcohol use at that point, just kind of the juvenile delinquent type stuff going on in the mid-60s. But then, you know, that was the era of the, you know, Haight-Ashbury and 60s, you know, all that counterculture stuff, anti-war movement. My mom was very much into that and went to the rallies in D.C. and all that. And, you know, I don't know what my dad thought of that. I can only imagine, but, you know, he kind of tolerated it. But they didn't have a real good relationship, you know, and we could see that. And again, there was a lot of chaos, yelling, screaming, throwing stuff. I was an okay student in school in, you know, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade. My dad was up around 1969, got transferred over to Thailand. This is as the Vietnam War was kind of, you know, ramping up and coming to a head. And by that point, my parents were basically separated, you know, and we moved to a development in Virginia called Reston, which was a very progressive, at that time was just starting, you know, very kind of counterculture and a lot of planned community type stuff, a lot of hippies there and whatnot. And I remember in 9th grade, I had a gym teacher, they were showing us a movie that, you know, don't start smoking pot because it's going to lead to needle drugs, you know, and hallucinogenics, and that kind of scared me. So I didn't want to have any of that going on, but it only scared me for so long, because eventually my mother and sister started smoking pot, and eventually they you know, asked me to join them. So as soon as I did that, it was kind of off to the races, you know. Started smoking pot, and by the way, my story involves drugs. I hope it doesn't offend anybody, but it is part of my story, like it says. We hope nobody will find these in bad taste. But you know, for me, it was more of everything. It wasn't just alcohol. Alcohol was always there. It was always, you know, the comforter. But at the beginning, it wasn't. I really didn't get into alcohol till a little bit later, but so in my junior high years, started smoking pot, and we eventually wound up moving to Sarasota, Florida, from Reston, Virginia, and That's the closest my mom could get to Hawaii. She just loved Hawaii, and Florida was kind of a, without going back to Hawaii, a nice, you know, solution for that. So we moved to Sarasota, Florida, and by that time, you know, I met some friends, and they were all the drug crowd, the pot smoking, acid taking, you know, smoking whatever crowd. And we were, my friends would come over to my house because it was cool, you know, we could smoke pot over there. My mom didn't care. So naturally, everybody loved coming over to my house. And one night we didn't have any pot, and my friend Woody said, "Why don't you go get your mom to go up and get a six pack?" Because we were underage. And so she walked up to the local bar up there, and sure enough, bought us the six pack. And you know, I had drank three beers, and I remember that feeling. That was the first time I got drunk off alcohol, and I loved it. You know, and that's the thing about alcohol is that it made me. It was different from pot. You know, pot made me more introspective, and kind of LSD did too, all the psychedelics. Kind of paranoid, but alcohol made me feel, you know, gave me that sense of ease and comfort that it talks about. And from that point on, it was there. You know, it was always there. I did a lot of other stuff, but the alcohol was always there. It was always drinking and, you know, even... replacing the bong water with wine or something, you know, and then drinking it afterwards. It was kind of gross. But hey, it's part of my story. So, you know, in high school, I developed... high school, junior high, and high school was where I really kind of found... a true sense of who I am as far as being a creative person. I was always interested in art and could draw really well, and I always was interested in music, and my mother bought me a set of drums, and my sister happened to be dating a guitar player, so we started playing together. And, you know, the drum just came naturally to me. I was very gifted. I was blessed with a very, you know, rhythmic talent, and never took a lesson in my life. But, you know, I did pretty well at it, and I enjoyed it, you know, and I, as much as drawing art and doing that kind of stuff. So in high school, that kind of developed. I got into a couple bands, and, you know, the lifestyle that goes along with that. The sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And there was certainly a lot of drugs and rock and roll. The sex, not so much. You know, it was, for me anyway, it wasn't. But I had no interest in anything in high school. You know, the pot and the alcohol just kind of sapped me of any motivation. And all I wanted to do was, you know, to play my drums. And I had no... really any adult supervision. My mother wasn't an adult. She was kind of a big child. And she tried her best, but, you know, there was only so much she could do. She was an alcoholic herself. And my dad, you know, by 1974, they were divorced after me being the youngest to graduate high school. And, you know, the drugs and alcohol, the crowd I was running around with in high school, that's what we were. We were freaks, you know. We had long hair, and yes, I had hair back then, believe it or not. It came down to here, and it was luxurious golden blonde hair. But that's who we were, you know. In high school, you had the jocks, and you had the freaks. And, you know, we certainly weren't, I wasn't going to be seen with any of those guys. So we did a lot of drugs, and we just had no, at least I didn't, had no motivation, ambition in life. But never really suffered any consequences from it until my graduation. And the graduation party got started by one of my band members coming over, bringing me a couple six packs of, I think it was either Heineken or St. Pauli Girl, something like that. And I started drinking that and took about three or four Valium and went out to the party on Longboat Key and more drinking out there, and the last thing I remember was a friend giving me a couple yellow jackets and Nembutal sleeping pills. And next thing I remember, I woke up on the side of the road with glass all over me, and I kind of came to and saw that I'd hit a speed limit, so I ran off the road, hit a speed limit, so I was in my mom's car, and, you know, it came, sliced the windshield, and by the grace of God, it didn't leave a mark on me, you know, but I was covered with glass, and I just kind of brushed it off and kept driving. And got home, and of course, you know, my mother and my dad was in town for the graduation. They kind of freaked out and wondered what happened, and I told them, oh, somebody must have smashed the windshield, you know. And that was a big lie, but they kind of accepted it. And, you know, that was the first real consequences of my drinking and drug use that happened. And, you know, that scared me for a little bit. But it was a continual pattern of, you know, stopping for a little bit and then picking it right back up again, being scared by something, and then, you know, picking it right back up again. Classic symptoms of an alcoholic. And, you know, this went on for a few years. I joined a couple bands, got in a couple bands, and we would do real well, and then, you know, my addiction would catch up with me, and, you know, I was kind of part of the rhythm section. And when you're high on Quaaludes and Coke and beer and alcohol, you know, you can't really keep a good beat, and I got kicked out, you know, unceremoniously of a few bands because, you know, the word was, Spence is a great drummer when he's sober, you know, and that was true. I was a good drummer, but I just could not keep off the pills and, you know, my obsession with getting high, because it really, you know, made me feel like somebody. It took away the pain of the, you know, anytime I was sober, I didn't like who I was. I felt real uncomfortable. And, you know, again, you can chalk it up to chaotic upbringing, household, but, you know, the fact of the matter is I'm an alcoholic, and, you know, we all have problems. That was the only way I could deal with them, my problems. The problem was always me. So, this pattern continued, again, for years, in different bands, in and out of different bands. I graduated high school. Was no ambition. I started dealing pot, and my brother got wrapped up in dealing coke, and my sister. I mean, there was always chaos in our family. It was just, you know, one thing happening here, and the whole crowd we were hanging out with, there's always consequences and chaos and stuff going on. And I remember my sister, older sister, got married to an addict, and, you know, he firebombed their house, and it's like this crazy stuff. But that's all we knew, you know. That was normal for us. We didn't know anything different, you know. And by this time, all my friends from high school, they kind of, at least a lot of them, they kind of moved on. You know, we all did that back in high school, but as we graduated and you know, got on in our years, they kind of went off and did more responsible things, like get jobs, you know, and I didn't. You know, I was pretty much floundering around, no real direction or ambition in life. And my drug usage and alcohol usage increased and got worse and worse. And it finally, you know, hit ahead after... let's see, it was probably, I went through a couple different girlfriends, moving in, living with them, stopped playing drums, really didn't want to have anything to do with that kind of life, just kind of signed off on that, and all that mattered was pursuing the high, you know, the drugs, the alcohol. And it got really bad. It was I was at a low point in 1980, and I was living with one of my ex-band members who was also an alcoholic, and living in his place after my girlfriend had kind of moved on, kicked me out. And, you know, we would wake up in the morning and it was rum and cokes to start the day, and then, you know, we'd drive around trying to find work and couldn't do that, and no work there. We weren't serious about it. We just, you know, we're looking for the next high. And this was a, apartment that had no electricity and literally a mattress on the floor with fleas on it. So it was kind of a, that was one of my bottoms. after stuff like that happening, you know, again, I'm trying to speed up the process here, because I know I'm running out of time. I don't want to get to the good stuff. But it finally came to a head in 1982, I want to say, when I was living with my mother and her new husband, and had been going to doctors to get prescriptions and pills and stuff, self-medicating myself, doctor shopping, and, you know, the drinking was always there. Again, it was always the underlying thing. That was just like, start off with the drinking and layer on all the other stuff. But, and I had graduated to, you know, needle drugs too, and I was putting stuff in my body that you shouldn't put in your body, and I wound up kind of overloading my body with some chemicals and alcohol, and my mom came in the bathroom and found me passed out on the bathroom floor with a needle hanging out of my arm, and, you know, I was just in a bad state. And she called the hospital, took me to the emergency room, had a few seizures, and they put me in the psych ward whenever somebody does something like that, because they think you're trying to take your life, you know. And, well, I wasn't doing that, you know. Consciously, I wasn't. But that was 5 North in Sarasota Memorial Hospital, and they locked me up there. And that was kind of the final straw for my family, which really said something, because they were pretty lenient and tolerant for most of my upbringing. You know, it was they kind of dismissed any little episode that happened, consequences, and it was, you know, they just, oh, he's just going through a phase, he's just doing that. But this was really the final straw when that happened. And they the rest of my family got together and decided, well, you know, it can't go on this way. And they basically came up to my floor in the wing there and, you know, confronted me with the fact that I was either going to get help, go into treatment voluntarily, or they were going to get a court order forcing me into it. And, you know, that came as a shock to me. That was a really kind of an eye-opening shock, and they left me alone there that night. And, you know, they were the ones that walked out, and the doors locked behind, and I was there, left. And I remember that feeling of just, the reality hit me that I can't go on this way anymore. I cannot live this way. And that's, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I think that was really kind of the reality of the first step sinking in, was that I knew that I had a problem and that I couldn't do any, you know, I couldn't go on this way, keep doing these things. And yet, I couldn't see a way out either. And I finally made the decision, though, okay, I'll go into treatment voluntarily. So they sent me to a 30-day program called the Friary up in Pensacola, Florida. Where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was, I can't tell you the sense of freedom and joy I had in finally getting sober, you know, after all those horrible years as it got worse and worse towards the end, that constant cycle, 24/7. So being sober for the first time in a number of years and having that freedom, I mean, it was a beautiful thing. And I kind of grabbed it and ran with it. And when I got back into town, you know, I was excited. I started working steps, got a sponsor, and going to a lot of meetings. And everything was good for a while. I was in a pink cloud, though. And when I got off that pink cloud, it was about 6 months later, I came to the, you know, decision that, well, maybe I've been sober 6 months now. Maybe I can drink a couple beers and be okay, you know. And a lot of people have that story. And so I tried it, and you know what happens. It just didn't work. It was just another trip, you know. Started, it was a couple beers one night, and then a couple six packs, and then back to the Coke dealer. And, you know, before I knew it, I was worse off than I was before. And only this time, I was trying to put on a front that I was doing okay, you know, and still going to meetings and bluffing people. And there's no worse feeling than that, going to meetings, you know, with that secret, knowing that I'm just living a lie. And these people, you know, I'm sure everybody knew it, but I thought I was kind of pulling the wool over their eyes. But anyway, that went on for a couple more years, and went back to doctor shopping until finally I got into got my second DUI, and by that point, you know, I was pretty well done. I'd had enough, and went into another 30-day treatment program in Naples, Florida. And thankfully, that was the last time, you know, that DUI I had was the last drink I had. And I had to kind of wean myself off the pill, or the treatment center weaned me off the pills that I was taking. But, you know, that was 1985, and I've been sober ever since. And when I got back into town after the second time, again, I was grateful for a second chance. And this time I really meant it. And, you know, I again got back into working the steps, got a sponsor, went to meetings. And everything was great, you know, and my life was going great. My sponsor said, you know, I told him, well, I'm working at an art supply store, and I don't really know what I want to do with my life. He said, what would you do if you could? You know, what would be the one thing you'd do? And I said, well, I'd go to art school. They had an art school there in Sarasota, Ringling School of Art. And he said, well, why don't you do it? You know, ask your father if he'd pay for that. And, you know, I was kind of scared, but I went ahead and did it. And he said yes. And, you know, that was part of my dream coming true, was to pursue my career as an artist. And so that was 3-year school, and I started, and not knowing what was going to happen, and things went great. You know, I did top of the class in what I was doing, and I enjoyed it, you know. And I went to school late, and I'm glad that I did, because I really took it seriously and got the most out of it, and graduated in 1989. And by that time, I met my wife, we got married, and, you know, the whole 3 years of school started off, you know, first year was good. I was going to meetings, and, you know, second year I was cutting back on the meetings, not doing so much, you know, and didn't have a sponsor, and wasn't cutting networking or anything. By the time I graduated in 89, I was going to maybe a couple meetings every month. And then we made a decision to move up here to Atlanta from Florida. And when we got up here, I didn't really have any contact with any, you know, by that time I'd stopped basically doing all the stuff that I was told to do and the things that got me sober. Now, mind you, I didn't want to drink. You know, God had removed the obsession to drink. And that's really the biggest miracle of my life, is that the steps in this program gave me the, you know, that higher power, God. I didn't want to drink, but little by little, my life was becoming unmanageable again. And as I came up, moved up here, got a job, great job. And that was, you know, I'm still employed at the same company, you know, 22 years. And while all the outside things looked good, you know, inside I was kind of dying, and because I didn't have a spiritual connection anymore, you know, I wasn't going to meetings, didn't have a sponsor, wasn't trying to be of service, and the old character defects started coming back again, and they really kind of took a toll on my wife. You know, you can imagine she was living with a sober alcoholic, a dry drunk. And it was just, I mean, there'd be good moments and then there'd be a lot of bad moments. And again, just like drinking, you know, I had a lot of bad character defects that kind of came to a head in 2000. After about 10 years of just going to maybe one meeting a year to get my wife off my back, not doing anything else, you know, no spiritual stuff. I started going to church for a while, but then dropped out of that because I didn't really think that, you know, the church was for me. But it finally came to a head when my wife broke down one night and said, "I can't take this anymore. You know, I cannot live with you in this state, and you've got to do something about it." And that was kind of an eye opener for me. And it finally dawned on me. It took her saying that to get me back into these rooms, you know. And it takes what it takes. I'm grateful that she did, because that was the only way I was going to get back in here, I think, was to have her, and I didn't want to lose her, you know, and her saying that got me back into these rooms, and I knew that I was going to have to take it seriously by that time. I knew I didn't have any way out, I didn't have anything else. I didn't want to go back to drinking and use drugs. I didn't want to drink, and again, the desire, compulsion wasn't there, but I knew I was going to have to get back into this program and really pursue it full out, you know, what, no half measures. So I started working the steps again. Came to the Wednesday Nighters meeting here and made that my home group, made me accountable. Got a little bit of time. The great thing about joining a group, which is one thing I had never really done before, was, again, it made me accountable. I met people, and more importantly, for the first time in 15 years, a young man came up and asked me to sponsor him. And I had never sponsored anybody before, you know, and I at that point, I felt like a newcomer, you know. I felt like coming back in after 10 years out of this program, I had no spiritual connection. I felt like I needed to pick up a white chip, you know, honestly. And I've been sober 15 years. That's how bad it was. But by the grace of God and this program and working the steps, you know, I made the decision. I told him, "Yes, I'll sponsor you." And that was the impetus that made me get a sponsor and to start working the steps again. I said, well, I told myself, I can't really sponsor somebody if I don't have a sponsor, and can't be a hypocrite, you know, and I got to do the things that I'm supposed to do. So I got a sponsor, started working the steps myself, and this time there were things that when I started back into the book, reading the book, and working those steps, like a lot of amends, a lot of stuff had happened over that 10-year period that I had wronged people and I had to make amends for. So I had to do another 4-step, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th. Through the process of working those steps again, this time with a real urgency, I guess is the best word, something happened and the light went off for me, you know, as far as my connection with God. That's when, you know, I kind of believed in God during the earlier years, but this time it really sunk in, you know, and there's so many things in the book that just kind of, I'd read it and it just like jumped out at me. And the process of working another 4th and 5th step and going on to make amends there was a 20-year man that I had not dealt with earlier on with an old girlfriend, and you know, that was the thing that was kind of in the back of my mind hanging me up. And by the grace of God, I was able to contact her and make that amend, you know, and I didn't have any idea where she was. I just kind of tracked her down through a friend and in Florida, and it took a while, it took a few months, but that's what my sponsor said I needed to do, just have the willingness to follow through, and I did it. And making that 20-year amend, that was a powerful thing, you know, it was really powerful. And the steps are powerful today, and I'm so grateful for people that God has brought into my life. And that's why, you know, when that young man asked me to sponsor him, I had no idea what I was going to do. I just knew I needed to do it, you know. And so I started working with him, and he stayed sober, and he helped other people get sober, you know, and he started another meeting somewhere, and, you know, other people came up and asked me to sponsor him. And working with others has been, that's really been kind of like the magic key for me. Just what that has taught me in conjunction with the rest of the steps is just kind of given me a servant heart, you know, where I feel that I can be of use and of service today in doing that. And anytime I help another alcoholic, it helps me stay sober, you know, and it probably helps me a lot more than it helps him. I don't know how many I've sponsored, you know, a few people. I don't know. There's a few of them that I know that stayed sober. Some of them have gone back out. But more importantly, I've stayed sober. And I've developed a relationship with God. You know, it's a lot stronger today. It's really a miracle. Because I had no kind of faith in my upbringing. Nothing at all, you can imagine. My parents were, you know, just no religion, no spirituality, nothing. So for me to come from that background to developing a God of my understanding, power greater than myself, is a real miracle. And through the process of working those steps and practicing principles in my life, you know, my life is so rich and full today. It's exciting. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love NADLA here. You know, there's so many good people here. And I look forward to every meeting I come to here. I mean, it's just my life on the outside may not seem like it's real exciting, but for me to be able to wake up every day sober with the freedom and ability to help somebody else, you know, whether I help them that day or not, you know, the fact that I'm sober and if I ask for God the strength, give me the strength to do that on a daily basis, to be of service, that's all I can ask for, you know, and do the footwork. There's a certain part in the big book that through this whole process, one day I was reading and it just like smacked me upside the head. And it's that part that says, the central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way that is indeed miraculous. And that, I'd read that before, I couldn't tell you how many times, but for some reason that it just jumped out at me, that's the central fact of my life today. The central fact of my life, you know, is a God of my understanding. It's not that I stopped drinking, you know, that's a byproduct of living this way of life. And that's why today it's about more than just not picking up a drink, you know. That bottom line is I gotta not pick up that first drink, but these steps and these principles have given me that kit, you know, spiritual tools that it talks about, that really have rocketed me into a fourth dimension of existence. And again, I'm so grateful for all the blessings in my life today. I'm grateful for the people here at the meeting. I'm grateful for my boss, who is saw fit to employ me for the last 22 years. You know, I'm so blessed to be working at a place where I work at basically an advertising agency that deals a lot. 90% of our clients are in the Christian ministries. And for me to be using my talents and gifts in a way that honor God is to this day, I still get up every morning looking forward to going to work, you know, and it's like, I'm sure some people can relate to this, maybe some can't, but it's incredibly satisfying to be using my gifts in a way that honors God. And in that creative sense, you know, that's, I've found who I was, who I am in that respect. And more importantly, I found that I can be of service today, and I want to be of service today. You know, I'm learning so much about who I am, humility, honesty, integrity. I heard somebody say a couple years ago that the road to recovery is always under construction. You know, and I really like that. That's the little sayings like that I like to hang on to. And there was another one that somebody said a few months ago, that AA has enabled me to see the big picture, and it's not a self-portrait, you know. And I really like that one, because that just like hit home, you know. It's not all about me anymore. There's so much more outside of me. I'm just a little speck, you know, sand on the beach. And if I can get that kind of mindset and that perspective, then, you know, that's the true meaning of humility, is knowing who and what I really am, followed by a sincere attempt to become what I could be. And I feel I'm doing that in this program. AA has given me the opportunity to do that, you know, on a daily basis. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity to share my story. I know that I don't always look forward to these things. I'm not the best public speaker, and I just try and muddle through it the best I can. And I could have told you lots of horror stories, but we would have been here all night if I had done that. But I would like to close with one thing now. This is something that caught my eye in the course of my work a few months ago. And some of you may have heard this before. It's called the Merton Prayer. And it just, there's so much AA wrapped in this. You know, it was written by a monk, I believe, Thomas Merton. But it says, "My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself, and the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire, and I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone." And that's how I really feel today. And this program has been such a blessing to me. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you.